though it's coming to us 24/7, it's rarely met with. Though Buddha nature is knocking on our door ceaselessly, we dally about, as Dogen says, missing the knock. Anything left over from this morning? Want to bring up to start with? Yes.
I'm sorry I wasn't able to attend the whole discussion. I did want to mention something that, related to mind, and gets back a little bit to what Michael said about the projection and the power that we have intrinsically in mind. I was listening to a radio report a couple of months ago about an American army soldier who was severely wounded in either Iraq or Afghanistan, and he was severely burned, and there are people who do not respond to pain medication, and he happened to be one of those people. They just weren't able to get the right drugs so that he, you know, could manage this recovery. And one of the staff at the hospital had heard about a technology, an immersive technology, that mimics the Arctic or the Antarctic with images of penguins and the ice caps and all those things that are down there. It's a completely immersive technology. And they asked him if he'd be willing to try it. And he was very, very skeptical, but he was in so much pain, decided to try it. And his pain levels came down by immersing himself in this completely fictional world of cold temperatures, cold environments. And I thought that was really quite remarkable. It kind of ties into a lot of the things that we were talking about in terms of what we consider to be the concrete world. So he, you know, it's to me that was interesting because he was such a skeptic to start with. But it helped him.
That's a good example, I think, of mind-only experiment. That, yeah, you create an imaginary environment that the mind, like you say, the mind is very powerful, and it responds in a new way with that such an environment, and changes one's whole being. And in this case, relieve suffering. So, and kind of a strange story, as a Dharma practice story, but very related, yeah, I think so. Thank you for that.
Sure.
Could you explain further the boundary between the pain of, say, getting your arm torn off physically and the pain that you feel just sitting here doing nothing?
The boundary.
You can ignore that.
You mean the pain, physical pain, sitting here for so long?
What? Yeah, pain is sort of a mind-only phenomenon. Mm-hmm. In some sense, it's, you know, you'd probably miss your arm, particularly while it's being torn off.
Yeah, well, I think with these mind-only teachings, or any Dharma teachings, really, they apply on all different levels. Like we were talking about this morning about, you know, we have really coarse stories about things that are obviously imagined and cause us great suffering. In fact, I think probably percentage-wise, more of our suffering comes from conceptual stories than physical pain, depending on the person. That person that you spoke of may be an exception, right? And who knows, from time to time, the physical is more overwhelming. But so with coarse conceptual stories and then very subtle, we could even say non-conceptual stories. Stories is a little stretch of the word, but that's where we start to get into these issues about direct perception and how colors and sounds, even in a non-conceptual way, are still mind projected according to this tradition. So therefore, I have the trust. I don't have the experience, but I have the trust that if one were to really realize the full extent of that every single experience we ever have is mind created, and therefore a kind of a distorted version of reality, a biased version of reality, maybe. You could say our mind is constantly biasing things. That, you know, by realizing the full extent of that, then even if our arm is being ripped off, we may be able to realize no suffering in the middle of that. Mm-hmm. The Buddha sometimes did bring up examples like that, even in the early sutras, about like being cut in half with a two-person saw and stuff like that, and not giving rise to anger and at such a time. And also we could say there's a lot of Buddhist practices around death, the time of death, and maybe after death. And you could say that's the biggest problem, maybe we could say, for us humans. And if we could really see that even the most extreme things, such as the death of this body, are not what we think, then we might be able to find complete freedom in that process too. But I think, you know, that's an extreme example. I think all these teachings would still apply, but I think very challenging to practice in such a way that they would apply. So that's why there's endless practice that we can do. We can endlessly deepen our practice to be able to face arms being torn off and so on. So the border, you say, between that and this is just, the border itself is mind only. Mm-hmm. Like the border is the difference between those experiences is a mentally projected one. I think it's important to see how to really explore what is suffering at its very root, what is discontent, what is dukkha in our life and practice, and do we believe, do we trust the Buddha when he says the complete cessation of dukkha is possible in this life? And we might not be at that point. We might feel like, well, I know that practice relieves suffering. That's why we're here doing it, because we know that it works. But when we're talking about arms being ripped off and stuff, it's like, I don't know if it applies there. So these are questions we could explore. Like, do we think, you know, through almost like reasoning, through kind of like the principle of how, what is suffering and what is the cessation of suffering according to practice, potentially could it apply there? And then we could reflect And do we want to take it that far? Do we want to take our practice that far? Or are we content with relieving some suffering? I think this is a question for any serious practitioners, a question I ask myself, because we can get to a kind of like plateau, I think, right, where we're like, this practice is working, it's, you know, I had like this level, I say this level of suffering up here, and now I'm like, it's down here, I've let go of a lot, I'm not as caught up in things as I used to be, and now life's pretty comfortable, and then it's easy to stay there, and that plateau could be a different place for everyone. We might drop down a little bit deeper, and then we have that plateau, and a question I find interesting and challenging to myself is like, do we want to drop even deeper for those times when our arms are ripped off? which is coming. At least death. We know death is coming in this life without exception.
It's interesting that the early Sangha, they had these practices, like a preceptor would give a student a certain practice if they were like too involved in the sensual realm. A preceptor would give a novitiate or a younger student, according to their personality, a practice of not necessarily, well, sometimes looking at death, but also looking at parts of the body in a kind of, you know, disgusting way, so that you see, they see really clearly, they see absolutely that it's temporal and that it's
getting more and more used to the body as it's just temporary conglomeration of elements. Yeah, even in modern times, I know of one American Buddhist community. It's kind of intense, but they would get photos from the autopsy
morgues,
and you can find some of these photos on the internet too. At one point, I was playing around with this kind of thing, just because it's so, you have this visceral reaction when you see those things. It's so like difficult to even look at the at a two-dimensional picture, right?
I had an experience like that. In high school, we lived in a university town, and the two of us were kind of going to be great artists, so we were going to learn how to draw anatomy. So we went into the medical, we just walked into the medical department, and there were graduate students there, and we said, we want to draw some cadavers. You know, we'd seen pictures of, various old masters that have drew cadavers and things like that. So we went in with our sketchbooks, and there were these big bins and these half-dissected things came up, and there were like chains that brought a tray up out of the formaldehyde bath. So they kind of rose up. They were like purple and green and gray, all dissected.
You say, okay, we've done enough sketching. Where are we going?
So, how did you become a Buddhist?
Maybe that was the point.
Does that come up in Zazen? Yeah, so I think it's to get to the point where actually it's not disgusting. It's not like we're like really into it or really not into it. It's more like it's just another image.
Just phenomena.
I recently came across this book that my parents were reading. It's called, I think it's called That's Disgusting. Something about disgusting, and it's like a kind of psychology book, or this, somebody did this study of like what makes things disgusting and how the mind works to create a sense of disgustingness and how it's different for different people. And one of the it's a big old book I didn't read, but near the beginning they have a disgusting test, like 10, like 20 questions to kind of rate your level of openness, tolerance for disgusting. And they're all different kinds of, you know, things like this. Like, if you were to see such and such a thing like this, you know, from 1 to 5, how would you rank it? And all different kinds of categories that were pretty absurd, but pretty disgusting. And, you know, like I thought, I don't think things are that disgusting, but like, you know, I was a little below average, but not that far. You know, there's certain things that are like universally, often around germs, and kind of like the body has natural responses to protect itself. So things like, you know, pieces of rotting bodies and stuff are like, we naturally are averse to that because there's a health hazard there. So it's like, it's a kind of universal thing. Anyway, how do we get into that?
Mind only.
Mind only! Of course.
The morgue. We went to the morgue.
Mind is a powerful thing, indeed. So now we're on to, we're back to only a Buddha and a Buddha. So again, all Buddhas of the three worlds, or three times, have already practiced, attained the way, and completed realization. So all these past Buddhas are already like, have already done that. How should we understand that those Buddhas are practicing together with us now? First of all, examine a Buddha's practice. A Buddha's practice is to practice in the same manner as the entire universe and all beings. That's a great statement. What's a Buddha's practice? Buddha's practice is to practice in the same manner as the entire universe and all beings. And remember that we've heard that the entire universe is the Dharmakaya, so if that's so, then it's natural that they practice together with their own Dharmakaya. So, what does this mean, that all Buddhas are always practicing with all of us and the whole universe?
In the same manner seems to imply that there's nothing unique or special or exclusive or nothing that...
What does that mean? In the same manner as us. So we could say that it's like the... from this mind-only perspective, we could say that the entire universe and all beings, including us, is the mind of a Buddha. A Buddha is, we could say, like projecting. Though maybe say that a Buddha no longer projects, but a Buddha's mind includes all of us and the entire universe, with no separation at all. So, therefore, we are not separate from Buddha's mind. And when we think of Buddha, that might be a projection of Buddha, but that projection of Buddha is not separate from our mind. So this is one way that mind only is this realm of intimacy where everybody is completely together. All Buddhas and all sentient beings are completely co-creating each other through their own minds. This would be one way to look at how we practice together. And then another way, you know, there may be infinite ways, but another angle on this would be that going back to our Buddha nature, right, that we have this unobscured, well, we shouldn't say unobscured, we have this pure, non-dual, empty awareness that, you know, in its nature is unobscured, but in practical terms, it's obscured by our habitual dualistic conceptuality. but that Buddha nature that's with us all the time is complete. That's who we really are, and that who we really are is practicing together with all Buddhas, Dharmakaya. Because our Buddha nature is not the slightest bit different from all the Buddhas in the universe, past, present, and future. Just like the guitar string theory of resonance, like we actually are resonating with Buddha all the time. So in that way, Buddha is practicing in the same manner as us. But you could say by us, this may mean who we truly are, our Buddha nature. Buddha is practicing in exactly the same manner as our Buddha nature is practicing. Because our Buddha nature is practicing. We might not feel as if we're practicing, but our Buddha nature is just being Buddha nature, being this non-dual, perfectly pure, clear awareness. It can't help it, self. That's what it is. And that is practicing together with all Buddhas. Yes.
To me, it feels more like having this profound sense of the interrelatedness of all things, and like stepping out of the window. And then he tries to put it into words. And so if we try too hard to understand these precise words, it seems to me that it's misleading or narrowing or something.
Yeah.
Because these words are just such a small reflection of the experience that we actually have.
Yeah. Yeah, anything we can say about it is another story. Mm-hmm. And so I think it is fair to say that the way that all Buddhas are practicing with us is inconceivable. We can't get a conceptual grip on the way that that we are so completely intimate, practicing in the same manner as all Buddhas. I think that's true. And so maybe it's even to say as much as I've said, maybe extra. I think that's true. Dogen didn't go so far as to say that, although he does say a lot here. But for me, it's interesting to explore when we get into this territory of things like all Buddhas are practicing in the same manner as us. Again, it's kind of like as Tony brought up the other day, like we might call hair splitting, or kind of analyzing ways to maybe understand this, or we can just take it on faith. And so if you're the type that can just hear all Buddhas are practicing in the same manner as us and feel like a wave of joy and exaltation upon hearing such a thing, then it may be enough. And for doubting types like Cliff and I, you have to explore a little more. I just throw these out as, you know, even this explanation of our Buddha natures practicing in the exact same manner as all Buddhas, that's also inconceivable, the way that works. But it's kind of, it points to something more than just this kind of statement that's just like, well, where is he even going, you know? Is it just a mystical experience that's completely beyond anything we can say? Maybe so. So I think it's always this issue of, you know, too much explanation or not enough explanation.
I'm just wondering.
When you say inconceivable, entirely?
Well,
because that kind of has that feeling to me. It's like there's no concept of it at all, you know,
The way it actually is so, because if we're talking about this non-dual clear awareness, by nature, that itself is inconceivable. So the way that our non-dual awareness is practicing in the same manner as Buddha's non-dual awareness, is almost kind of, by definition, inconceivable. But then when you say completely so, well, maybe not, because like we can talk about it that much. We can say that much. And to me, that's like a step beyond just saying all Buddhas and all beings are just practicing together. That's so open that it often, my mind goes, well, that sounds great, but like it doesn't really, I can't do anything with that. But then when I start kind of contemplating, and this is just the way my mind works, right? So your mind might not work this way, but my mind starts saying, well, what, you know, what's the principle behind that? How could that be? So then my conceptual dualistic mind can come up with this story, like, well, because I really do deeply trust this, that we have this clear awareness. Sometimes we can tap into that, actually, this Buddha nature we can tap into in Zazen, in our life. At the time we're tapped into it, we're not like reflecting, oh, this is Buddha nature, just as I thought, as Dogen says. It's not like that. But we can taste it in these little ways, and therefore then we can really trust that that that's who we truly are, and that that's, that way we truly are is practicing in the exact same manner, completely in accord with all Buddhas. And therefore, this goes back to only a Buddha and a Buddha, only a Buddha together with a Buddha, only our Buddha together with all Buddhas of the three times, together practicing in the same manner and realizing the true mark of all things together.
So we can we can taste it in little ways and perhaps taste more.
Perhaps.
I believe so.
Yeah. In fact, we can become as Dharmakaya, Buddha, and fully like swallow the whole thing, not just taste little bits and pieces.
Like when we were talking earlier about the complete, or you were talking about earlier, the complete cessation of suffering.
Mm-hmm.
I think you really, I mean, you have to believe that, even beyond faith, really. So, or I do, anyways. I have to believe that.
Believe it, like on principle, or because of the way it works?
Yeah, believe that this is the nature of reality. That there is, and in order to fulfill vow, there's no way I can't believe that if I believe in the vow, you know.
Mm-hmm. The Bodhisattva vows.
Yeah. I can't pull that apart.
Yeah. So. Well, yeah, strictly speaking, again, if we really take up those vows seriously, or, you know, if we listen to what we're saying, it's pretty, like, intense thing that we say. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to become it. And this is bodhicitta, traditionally, too. Bodhicitta is not the wish to, like, become a little, you know, again, kind of strictly speaking, it's not the wish to be, like, a little more peaceful in our lives, right? It's the vow to, like, become a completely realized Buddha in order to, like, save. It's kind of a taboo word, right? Save! Hallelujah! Save all these beings! Infinite, numberless beings, I vow to save them, free them from suffering. It's huge thing to say, right?
That's the part of the vow I was thinking of in particular. Yeah. It's like, unless I at least maybe don't have complete understanding of the complete cessation of suffering, believe that it is, can be realized.
Mm-hmm.
If I don't believe that, how can I believe that vow?
Yeah.
You know?
I think that's true.
How can you save all beings if you can't believe, if you don't believe in complete cessation?
Yeah, I think that's true. This could be a problem if we start to think about this, that we might reinterpret, like, to say, beings are numberless, I vow to say them. Means, for me, it means it's like, be nice to the people around me. You know, that'd be kind of like a limited interpretation. But we could interpret it like kind of literally, that numberless sentient beings are incredibly suffering, and I vow, however long it's going to take, I don't even care, but I vow to free every last one from suffering. And then when they're all free, then I myself will leap into complete nirvana. And all four vows too, right?
Sure.
Delusions are inexhaustible. Like every single thought we're having is kind of a delusion. Everything I'm saying now about enlightenment is delusion. So I vow to cut through all of that and, you know, never give rise to a deluded thought. Maybe this sounds extreme, but I think that's what the vows are saying. They're totally radical. Dharma gates are boundless. You know, I vow to, literally, it's like learn them, study them, is gaku. So it means like all these Dharma teachings is like, well, this is, you know, maybe we're getting too into this, like, but you could say every sentence of Dogen, we vow to like unravel it completely. And Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to actually realize Buddha. So, it's maybe a long project. Maybe immediate. Because actually time is just another delusion that we have to cut through. So it's not really a matter of three countless eons, like some might say, or one moment. Because all Buddhas are practicing in exactly the same manner as all beings.
Is it possible, I mean, to also look at that from, I mean, look at the same thing from kind of a different starting point?
Everything is possible.
I remember in earlier discussions, there was some comment that rather than we come from the place of our aspiration or our effort to meet this universal place, that it's actually the universal place itself kind of waiting for us, you know, and coming to meet us.
Yeah.
And what's
mutually.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it says a Buddhist practice is to practice in the same manner as the entire universe and all beings, mm-hmm. which means enlightenment and delusion. It means being down in the mud and also in an elevated state. Mm-hmm. It means all the mess. It means everything. Right?
And yeah, and what about the mess is then our question. So like Dogen says, those who have great realization of the mess of delusion are Buddhas.
Buddhas, yeah.
Like that's one of Dogen's definitions of a Buddha, right? Those who have great realization of delusion, whereas those who are greatly deluded about realization are sentient beings. Which is a little bit like that first paragraph. All the thoughts we have about realization are our delusions about realization. That's what we sentient beings think about. But
so the sentence is pretty inclusive, isn't it?
Includes all beings.
All beings.
And delusion. But then we have to really examine, well, what does that mean? Like, or even if we say, like, our wallowing in the mud of delusion is itself enlightenment. We hear this kind of thing in Zen, right? But I think if we use that as some kind of excuse to be like, well, then let's just wallow in the mud and total suffering, and like, cool, we're all suffering. Like, what's the difference between that and not even having these vows or, you know, not even practicing? And we could say ultimately maybe no difference, but then, you know, what are we doing? I think this is interesting and hard to talk about. area, right? Well, like, what would you say is, if we say that our delusion itself is enlightenment, like, what does that actually mean, or how can that help us?
Well, again, I would say that that's someone had that insight and expressed it, and it's not really that. It's something that it necessarily is being told to other people as what they should believe or what they should know. It's just a reflection of that experience that he had.
So when. And for us, then we could like try, or maybe something rings true if we hear those words, something like, that's way different than how we usually think of things, but actually, maybe could be possible.
Yeah, there might be a little vibration.
A vibration, yeah, yeah, vibration there. You know, and, you know, when I hear that, when I hear Buddhas are those who have great realization of delusion, that means they actually have, you know, an understanding.
They've studied it.
A realization, an understanding of delusion. Mean that they're still deluded, but they understand what it is. And that also might be the principle of great delusion is itself great enlightenment. It's like the nature of delusion, which, you know, is, from these various perspectives, the nature of every single deluded thought is, we could say, empty of what we think it is, or, you know, it's just, it's mind, and mind is perfectly pure. It's just manifesting as a delusion. That's one kind of principle that actually makes it, even though that's still inconceivable, I think, it at least opens it up a little bit. It's pretty hard for me to just hear that delusion. I guess I just want to say that it's easy to say things like Zen is famous for all these sayings, right? That like delusion itself is enlightenment. And to kind of like almost like use it as an excuse to like maybe not plunge wholeheartedly into this vow to become Buddha. Do you know what I mean? Delusion's enlightenment, and I'm totally deluded. So I must be totally enlightened. So let's go home. We're done.
Something like that. Like a student said that once to Suzuki Roshi, like something like delusion is enlightenment. No, he said it first, and the student said it, and he said, "No, you're wrong. But you just said that. No, I said it was right, but you say it, it's wrong."
So, of course, it has been said by these great ancestors, and not necessarily that they were right either, just because they got recorded in the ancient texts or something. But we just have to check. We just have to be really honest with ourselves, is how a teaching like that either moves us, deepens our bodhicitta, you could say, or undermines our bodhicitta. Maybe that's a way to put it. And it could be, for different people, it could, and at different times, it could be either way, constantly back and forth. We just check. Yes.
So I have to apologize too. I haven't been able to come to all the gatherings, but Samsara is catching up with me. This vow to save all sentient beings was a great bait for me when I was younger too, and so there's, as we all know, there's so many possible interpretations. And like, to save all sentient beings from suffering, then there wouldn't be samsara.
Yeah. It seems like samsara is based on suffering.
Yeah, you know, yeah.
To some degree.
So you could say that's a vow to end samsara.
Yeah, it's a vow to end. And, mm-hmm. And indeed, as you know, better than I do, there is in the Buddhist scriptures lots of talk about emptying samsara.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Which, you know, that's interesting consideration. You know, does that mean the end of the world? You know, it's interesting. Mm.
Yeah, you know, offhand I would say, I think it means the end of the world.
Yeah, yeah.
As we know it.
Yeah, right. But then there's the more subtle formulation of saving all sentient beings from unnecessary suffering.
Mm.
And I kind of like that, because that seems to be maybe more possible than just blanket saving all beings, period, you know, from suffering.
What's the difference between necessary and unnecessary?
There you go, exactly. So, you know, and in my life and in your life, yeah, or in all of our individual lives, you know, some people appear to have just one hell of a lot of suffering.
Mm.
And other people seem to skate through, you know, and is this a reflection of previous lives, you know, and so on and so forth, and our more innate intelligence and so on. It's really complex.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a huge question. And we also could say, well, even if it means all suffering to the very bottom, still we can start with the unnecessary.
Yeah.
And practical, in practical ways of, you know, just the most mundane practical ways of helping out people in difficulty is part of that. I think it's not just this abstract vow. It's like, it's a moment-to-moment thing, and it could also include all of it completely. And then we have the Platform Sutra of the Sixth Ancestor, where he brings up these four vows, and he says, the Wei Nong, the Sixth Ancestor, says, saving all beings means saving all beings in my own mind, he says. So, it's kind of a mind-only thing, right? He's saying, actually, the suffering of beings is my projection. I have to say they're not actually out there, and the suffering's not actually out there in the first place. But again, we could hear that as excuse to not help somebody in need because, oh, they're just my mind. So, yeah, it's a huge, complex issue. But I think I hear that as a hint, though, from the Sixth Ancestor, that if we see it all as like everybody's separate and they're not my mind, and there's all this suffering is really real, and we have to fix all of it one at a time, that can be a daunting thought. Can give us a headache just to think about it. Whereas if it's like just a little clue about save all beings in my mind, makes this possible to like, well, maybe the way that I think samsara, that beings are suffering, is actually, everything's askew. My whole way of thinking of infinite suffering beings is not really the way it is, because that's just a delusion that I haven't ended yet. Like at one time I was, this thing about emptying out samsara, I was really suffering thinking about this, you know, one teacher had said to me something like, you know, unless you like give up this, that, and that, and like practice like this, this, and that, how are you ever going to end samsara? And it hooked me. I was like, yeah, actually, this is all samsara. How are we going to end this? And I was just sweating and churning and disturbed by this, and then I went to my teacher and said, well, look at these things that we're doing all around here, like, how are we going to like end samsara like this? And he just kind of like smiled and said, samsara doesn't exist the way you think it does. And like, it was one of those turning moments for me, because I was so caught up in like this thing of ending samsara. It's like, well, what is samsara? It's actually a delusion. My way of thinking about this huge samsaric suffering world is maybe not how things really are. So therefore, emptying out samsara, ending samsara, may not be as like far away as we think. And in Zen, of course, then this can become like a moment-to-moment thing. You know, one moment of zazen, you can completely empty out all of samsara. But in the next moment again, it's like, oh, but my knee. Now there's like huge realms of samsara like crushing us from all directions. But anyway, if it's not practice with all beings, it's not a Buddha's practice. This being so, all Buddhas, from the moment of attaining realization, realize and practice the way together with the entire universe and all beings. Now, as we've been discussing this, you may have doubts about this. I think I might have some doubts about this. But the ancient Buddha's word was expounded in order to clarify your confused thinking. Do not think that Buddhas are other than you. According to this teaching, when all Buddhas of the three worlds, the three times, arouse the thought of enlightenment and practice, they never exclude our body and mind. You should understand this. To doubt this is to slander the Buddhas of the three worlds. It's kind of strong. That's when Dogen's bringing out his fire and brimstone. Right? To even like, well, really? Could this really be? Secretly, we're doubting it. But that's slandering the Buddhists to even doubt Dogen, right? Buddha's bodhicitta includes us, and our bodhicitta includes Buddha's. And we, you know, this way that they include delusion, or that they are willing to go into our delusion, they completely accept our delusion because they realize that our delusion is not delusion. If they thought our delusion was really delusion, like an unworkable kind of delusion, Buddhas like might not even go there. I think that's too much to practice with. That person's delusion is like really delusion. So, you know, at least that person, I can't practice with them. But Buddhas don't think like that. Because they see, like, however deep we think our delusion is, however unworkable it is, the Buddhists see it as totally workable because delusion is not delusion. Or the true nature of delusion is that it's free from being delusion. Thinking that delusion is like the definition of delusion. Thinking that enlightenment is enlightenment is also a definition of delusion. Thinking that delusion is enlightenment is also delusion. Thinking that enlightenment is delusion is also delusion. But actually, all those thoughts are not really delusion. Okay. We got that clear. Oh, you should understand this. Let's see, to doubt this. When we reflect quietly, it appears that our body and mind has practiced together with all Buddhas of the three worlds and has together with them aroused the thought of enlightenment. So if, you know, if I'm talking about, if I'm trying to get around this issue of our delusion by saying it's our pure Buddha nature that's entrapped in our body and mind that's practicing with all Buddhas, now Dogen's saying actually our body and mind has practiced together with all Buddhas and has together aroused the thought of enlightenment. So it's bringing it even closer to home. When we reflect on the past and future of our body and mind, we cannot find the boundary of self or others. Also, we cannot find the boundary of ourself and Buddhas, or sentient beings and Buddhas. The boundary of delusion and enlightenment, we're having trouble finding it recently. By what delusion do we believe our body and mind is apart from all Buddhas of the three worlds? Such delusion is groundless. How then can delusion hinder the arousing of the thought of enlightenment and the practicing of the way by all Buddhas of the three worlds? Thus understand that the way is not a matter of your knowing or not knowing. So, very apropos of this discussion, that how can delusion hinder the arousing of the thought of enlightenment and the practicing of the way by all Buddhas of the three worlds and by us? Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. But how do those very delusions hinder the ending of them? How can they? So, a teacher of old said, Dogen loves those teachers of old, chopping down is nothing other than chopping down. Moving about is beyond discussion. So chopping down is boku raku. You may know that term, shinjin datsu raku, body and mind dropped off. So it's the same raku. Raku means dropping off, letting go, falling away. And boku means something like to pound or to strike. So together, chopping down, well, I think that's a funny phrase, chopping down. Another translation is crashing down, but also maybe just dropping away, but in a kind of like, in a kind of energetic way. Maybe this is why the this chopping, striking.
Who is his teacher?
Xinjiao Xiaoshou, which I couldn't find anything else about. He's not in Andy Ferguson's Book of the Ancestors. And then this phrase, moving about, is actually literally means vertical and horizontal in Chinese. So we could take that as the world. You put vertical and horizontal together, you have the whole 10 directions world, would be one interpretation. And one footnote says this means like Buddha's freely flowing discourse, vertical and horizontal, as in the Bendo Wa, where Buddha at the beginning of Bendo Wa, the first Shobogenzo essay, Dogen says, talking about this inconceivable Dharma, he says, when you speak it, when you speak this inconceivable Dharma, it fills your mouth. It is not bounded by length or width. And that's the same characters here, vertical and horizontal, length and width. So if it's a Zen phrase for speaking of the inconceivable Dharma being not restricted by vertical and horizontal speech about the world, then we could maybe translate this as something like, dropping away is nothing other than dropping away. Unrestricted speech of Buddha beyond vertical and horizontal is beyond discussion.
I personally would like to go with the first interpretation, the vertical and horizontal in Chinese, this means 10, so it really is literally the 10 directions. That would be my way, because the character is the It's nice to stay close to the characters. I love the second interpretation, but the first one seems crossing.
I don't know if when you put these two characters together, if they mean 10, or if that's a kind of play on it. Because they're not actually the lines.
The lines, but but vertical and horizontal usually put together, it makes a 10.
But when you put the Chinese character for vertical and the character for horizontal, when you combine those, they're not actually the lines.
Interesting.
No, it's actually it's a boku and rock and.
Can I have the characters?
Or, yeah. Do you know offhand? Do you want to see? It's so it's about halfway down the page here. These two thick-looking ones, but I think this is a nice interpretation. Is the world is beyond discussion. The ten-direction world is beyond discussion. Mountains, rivers, and the great earth are the entirely revealed body of the Dharma King. So now we're back to the Dharmakaya. As the whole universe, great earth and mountains and so on. Mountains, rivers, the great earth are the entirely revealed body of the Dharma King. And, you know, as we were discussing this morning in the past days, I was having personally like a little trouble with what is this Zen thing about saying that the Dharmakaya, which is this pure, uncompounded, non-dual awareness is like mountains, rivers, and the earth. It's like, that's such a leap. It's cool leap, right? But it's like, again, my kind of skeptical and analytical mind goes like, what's going on there? And why does this happen like regularly amongst these Zen people? And I just today found this note that I was really happy to find by Thomas Cleary, who's good with these things, in the Blue Cliff Record, and he says, it's a note about the Dharmakaya and Zen take on the Dharmakaya. So he says, according to esoteric Buddhist teaching, which is, I think, like the Shingonshu, you know, like Japanese and Chinese Vajrayana, the exoteric schools, like Tiantai and so on, there's In China and Japan, they're often talking about the exoteric schools and the esoteric. So exoteric are more like straightforward Dharma presentation, mind only, and middle way teachings are kind of out exoteric, meaning like they're just outward. They're not secret, like the esoteric, subtle Vajrayana type teachings. According to the esoteric teachings, the exoteric schools regard the Dharmakaya as being unmanifest and inexpressible and the uncompounded. And that's the thing is, I guess I'm just more used to this exoteric teachings about the Dharmakaya. It's unmanifest and unexpressed. And then you have the Nirmanakaya is the manifestation body. But the Dharmakaya is like vast emptiness. So how can we call it mountains, rivers, and earth? So that's what the esoteric schools say about the exoteric. But then the esoteric schools themselves say that the Dharmakaya is also manifest and expressive. So that was this, I thought, this little light bulb went off. Like, this is, there is this teaching, even before Zen, to like call this inconceivable, unmanifest Dharmakaya, to say that it's actually manifest as like the entire universe, and we hear the Dharma body of the Buddha is the entire universe. We probably was taught even before Zen, people started saying things like that. And then Cleary says, the Zen tradition sees both sides of this. In other words, the Dharmakaya being unmanifest and unexpressed, inconceivable, empty awareness, and also expressed and manifest as like mountains, rivers, earth, and the universe. And for example, there seems to be these three main koans in the Blue Cliff Record about the Dharmakaya, one of which I brought up this morning about the indestructible Dharmakaya is the mountain flowers bloom like brocade, the valley streams are brimming blue as indigo. Then we have another case, 47, where a monk asked Yunmen, what's the Dharmakaya? And he said, the six don't take it in. And one interpretation of this, which, of course, the Blue Cliff Record commentaries, they mention various interpretations that are pretty good, and they say, if you think like this, you're totally missing the point. Even though they give you some good interpretations, they just say, if you're trying to get it conceptually, you won't. But I always appreciate the interpretations before he cuts them down. So the six do not take it in is one reference, is the six senses cannot take in the Dharmakaya. In other words, it's the inconceivable, unmanifest. What's the Dharmakaya? Yunmen said, six do not take it in. Six cannot take it in. But then another time, a monk asked Yunmen, what's the pure Dharmakaya? In case 39. And Yunmen said, a flowering hedge. So I think this is what Thomas Cleary means by Zen has both these sides. The Dharmakaya is unmanifest, unexpressible. Six senses, including the mind, cannot take it in. This world out here, mountains, rivers, and earth, the six senses totally take that in. That's what they do. That's all they take in, is this world. So on the one hand, the six don't take it in. And another occasion, what's the Dharmakaya? The flowering hedge out there, and the mountains, rivers that seem to be out there. So it's like a kind of pre-Zen teaching, but the Zen people love the Dharmakaya being the great earth and mountains and waters and all. When you understand, it said, mountains, rivers, and the great earth are entirely revealed body. Revealed, not unrevealed, not unmanifest, but manifest, revealed, or bare and exposed body of the Dharma king, of the Buddha. A person of the present should study this phrase of the teacher of old. There's a Dharma king who understands that the body of the Dharma king is not different from chopping down, or not different from dropping away. Just as mountains are on earth and the earth is holding up mountains. So mountains depend on the earth, earth depends on mountains. There, we could talk about the two different things, but actually we can't find a separation between them, just like the Dharma king, being the Buddha, is not anything other than this dropping away. Which is a little bit like earlier in this fascicle, we heard something like, when Buddhas are saving beings, that is the manifestation of the Buddha body. In other words, it's not like you first have the Buddha body and then the Buddha body saves beings. It's like the very activity of freeing beings from suffering is itself the manifestation of the Buddha's body, whether we or anyone's aware of that or not. In the same way, the Dharma king, the Buddha, is actually nothing other than, I guess it doesn't go that far, but maybe we could see nothing other than this dropping away, cutting through, chopping down. when you understand, a moment of no understanding does not come and hinder understanding. Or when you understand, the time of no understanding does not come and hinder understanding. And understanding does not break no understanding. Or another translation clarifies this, or maybe limits it, but maybe makes it simpler by saying, when you understand that, you know, this previous time of not understanding before you understood doesn't hinder your understanding right now. Anyways, right now you suddenly understand. A moment ago when you didn't understand, that's no longer hindering your understanding. We could say, like, the obstructions to Buddha nature are not operating at the time when Buddha nature is fully manifest. And understanding does not break the previous not understanding. Instead, understanding and no understanding are just like spring and autumn. So understanding comes like springtime, and then we're back in delusion again in autumn. Dogen elsewhere brings up the story of does a greatly realized person return to delusion? And he's got a whole essay called Great Enlightenment about this point, which is kind of like what we were discussing earlier, this relationship of realization or realization and delusion. Very subtle relationship. Like spring and autumn have a pretty subtle relationship themselves. However, when you do not understand, the pervasive voice of Dharma does not reach your ears. It's like the Buddha nature that's knocking, but it's not reaching our ears. In the midst of your voice, in the midst of the voice of Dharma, your ears dally about. Dally.
Strange phrase.
Yeah, so later, you know, Kaz Tanahashi, in his new version of this, there's occasional places where he changed it, and this is one of them. So maybe he thought that was too strange, dally about. But it almost has almost opposite meaning, because he changed it to remain idle. So it's almost like these two problems that we have.
In the new translation?
Yeah, in the new translation it says, in the midst of the voice, your ears remain idle. So it's kind of nice that he has these two different translations, that because that's what our ears... Dharma is coming at us, right? The unsurpassed, penetrating, perfect Dharma coming at us. But our ears are either dallying about, like we're just thinking about Kinhin coming soon, or we're like, or our ears are remaining idle, like we're just like drooling, like, what's happening? Like half asleep. It's kind of like the two different, either we're like distracted or we're just like dull. But dullness and distraction are struck aside at the moment that Buddha nature is shining forth. But when you understand, your voice has already reached your ears, samadhi has emerged. Or we could turn it and say, samadhi emerging is when Buddha's voice reaches our ears. Could we hear that as almost like a definition of samadhi, which is this one-pointedness of mind, where we're like the self and the objects of consciousness are getting closer and closer together, until there's like the projections of mind out there are just drawn back in, and there's just one pointed being, that the external world is no longer impinging on us. So to say that samadhi is when the voice of Dharma actually reaches our ears, when Buddha nature knocks actually when our door opens and we let Buddha nature take a seat, non-dual, clear awareness, samadhi has emerged. Know that no understanding cannot be discerned by a self. The Dharma King's understanding is just like this. And so that's a funny sentence. Here's another translation that sounds completely different. Know that no understanding is not great and understanding is not small. The Dharma King is beyond our self's conceptions. That's close to what Nishijima translates it as, which I think is more straightforward.
Read that again.
Know that no understanding is not great and understanding is not small. Meaning like all the time when we're deluded and not understanding, don't think that the great amount of what's happening is just vast illusion and that understanding is very small experience that we have. You know, don't think that way. The Dharma King is beyond our self's conceptions. Our self thinks that we're just basically wallowing around in delusion all the time and we never have any understanding. But the Dharma King can be manifesting to us all the time, but beyond our limited self's conceptions of it. Whereas the way the Kaz translates it here is, I don't know what to do with it myself. Know that no understanding cannot be discerned by a self, because it seems like the no understanding that he's been talking about is pretty straightforward, like just not understanding. And in a way, that's what is discerned by the self. So the Dharma King's understanding is just like this. But we don't have to make perfect sense of every sentence of Dogen, luckily. In the Dharma King's body, the eye is just like the body and the mind is the same as the body. There's not the slightest gap between mind and body. Everything is fully revealed. So, surely from mind-only perspective, there's not the slightest gap between mind and anything, including and especially the body. Everything is fully revealed. Similarly, you should understand that in illumination and discourse or expounding Dharma, the Dharma King's body is revealed. In illumination, komyo is, you know, brightness. The Buddha's brightness. Dogen has a fascicle called komyo. Yeah. So in that just non-verbal, non-conceptual brightness of Buddha's awareness, and in Buddha's expounding Dharma and discourse with words, in both cases, the Dharma King's body is revealed.
Kokyo, you go so deep. I mean, I feel like I can just be a little junkie following you around. You know?
And your Buddha nature is absorbing all of it. And so, you know, it's a funny thing that we do here, huh? Isn't it? Genzoe Sashin. All these words. All this, what do we call it? Hair splitting. And mixed in with pure poetry and zazen and tea. And this is strange, but ancient tradition to gather like this and do this kind of thing. And I just feel personally really blessed by the opportunity, even though it might just be like adding delusion upon delusion upon delusion. And, you know, we could have just been sitting zazen and watching samadhi emerge as the Dharma enters our non-dallying ears. But I trust that turning Dharma through words like this has some effect. It's seeping into our system, and the way it might ooze out of our pores later on, might be helpful. May it be helpful. May it save all beings. May it end all delusions. May it help us enter all Dharma gates. May we all become Buddha.